Welcome, everybody. There are some materials on the Financial Series website, so this is fyi.uwex.edu/financial-series, all one word. And you'll find there on the homepage a link for counseling and education for homebuyers. On that posting, which was made on January 4th, you'll see there's a couple of sentences written. At the last sentence, it says, read the housing counseling issue brief _ in blue, at least in my browser. If you click on that, that will bring up the brief that we'll I'll be talking about today, but I'll be talking about more than just that brief, but at least specifically when I'm talking about articles or authors, you know the specific reference without having me have to recitate that over the phone.
Will you give that address again?
It's in the email that I sent out for this call initially. It's fyi.uwex.edu/financial-series, one word. All these calls are, the brief for these calls are posted beforehand, and then afterwards the archive, the audio archive, which is set up as a podcast, is available. So that's a good way if you aren't able to make a call to find more information about the call by listening to it on a podcast or on your computer. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and get started. I want to welcome everybody to the first Financial Series Lunchtime Learning Call of 2011. Happy New Year to everybody. We have a series of calls that we do every second Monday of the month, and we focus on sort of hot topics in family financial education, topics that come from people on the family financial education team or people out in the field who want to explore a topic in more depth. This is different from our Building Bucks series. Building Bucks takes place on the third Monday, except for this month because of the holiday, of every month. And those calls are focused on the basics, the building blocks of financial education. We cycle through the same 9 topics every year. Financial Series is different. It's really focused on hot topics as they come up. And today's topic is homebuyer counseling. Homebuyer education and counseling is a topic that's come up quite a bit from folks out in the county, educators, and folks out across the state, particularly thinking about ways to respond to the foreclosure crisis. So on the one hand, we have people who are in foreclosure in communities, and what do we do? How do we help people once they get into trouble? On the other hand, how do we prevent this trouble from happening in the first place? And wouldn't education have been a way to address the problems that people are facing before they happened? Maybe if they had a lot more information, they wouldn't be in the situation they are. So my goal for today's call is at about 35, 40 minutes, something like that, summarize what we know from research in the area of home buyer education and counseling, both pre-purchase and post-purchase, so after people are in the house and they get into trouble. This is, of all the areas that I research, this is one that I have the most direct experience with. I spent about 6 years running both research and direct programming around homebuyer education and counseling for Neighborhoods America. So this is a topic that I can talk about both as a practitioner and as a researcher. So I'm happy to hold a bit of time at the end to talk about questions and answers. Before I get started, does anybody have any questions? Okay, hopefully people were able to get in, and we'll get rolling. And, I would encourage you to stop me at some point. If you have questions, I will pause occasionally to ask for questions as well or comments, and then we can spend the last 15 minutes or so really talking about the issues related to this that you think are most interesting. The first thing I would say about home buyer education and counseling is, like the rest of the financial literacy education field, there isn't a whole lot of applied research or even theoretical research. Homebuyer education and counseling is probably the oldest and most well-supported part of financial education. Financial education and counseling as a field really has only grown in the last 10, 15 years. The homebuyer education and education for people around housing topics goes back to the 60s. Including some studies that took place in the early 60s, particularly around rental housing, and a little bit on people in foreclosure as well. So it's probably one of the older areas of financial education, and yet, much like the rest of the financial education field, we don't have very many studies that are conclusively show impact. And some of the studies we do have are sort of hard to generalize from because of the way they were designed is not necessarily something you could replicate. It's hard for you to replicate something that, say, the federal government's FHA program could do. So we've definitely got some limitations in the field in general, and housing counseling and housing education sort of reflects that general limitation in the field. Now, a lot of studies that have been done tend to be small scale, and some of them are so esoteric that it's hard to draw any conclusions from. So I'll talk a bit more about general conclusions from this literature at the end, but I just want to preface that in the beginning that, you know, when I talk about some of the limitations of this homebuyer education and counseling area, it's very similar to what we see across homebuyer financial literacy education in general. Relatively new field, relatively understudied, and not a lot of conclusive evidence. So as we talk about homebuyer education and counseling, I just want to talk a little bit about terminology, because I know the terminology can get thrown around and it can become confusing as we think about what exactly are we talking about. We tend to think about this field is in two parts, and even that's not fair, but as a broad generalization, there's pre-purchase and there's post-purchase. Pre-purchase means before you sign the contract on the mortgage to close the deal. That's pre-purchase. So that can include everything from, you know, a couple of years before I take part in a home buyer's club to try to get my credit together to be able to buy a house to, you know, 2 hours before the closing I take part in some online seminar so I understand what APR means. All of that's captured in this pre-purchase notion. Post-purchase is anything that happens after the deal is done. Typically when we talk about post-purchase, it means people who are in trouble and are not making payments or in default or at risk of default. And so the counseling is trying to get them to pay again. Certainly post-purchase does not just need to be that crisis intervention kind of counseling and education, but that's typically what we've seen. There are programs that do post-purchase education, say, around home repair or how to do a refinance. But those programs are relatively rare, and as such, they just haven't been evaluated. So we can't say much about what the literature says about those kinds of programs. So with that said, so there's two big categories, this pre-purchase and post-purchase. And then within either category, you can think about education or counseling. Counseling, most people think of as a one-on-one or, you know, one counselor with a couple or a household. Whereas education, typically people think about as being more of a group setting. Now, a group may be one or two people as well. So, both of these things can be kind of fluid. And I'm sure you've been in educational settings where essentially counseling takes place because either people peer counsel each other or you're doing counseling one-on-one while the rest of the group is listening in. So fully recognize that pre-purchase and post-purchase could take the form of education or counseling, group or individual, and that it's pretty dynamic, pretty fluid what people might be in at any given point in time. Typically, counseling takes place because people are under some time pressure or they have some specific technical issue they need to look at. So we do counseling one-on-one because we've got to get them through to the closing or because they're about to lose their house to foreclosure. Education is tougher in those kinds of settings. Or because it's a real technical issue that a group wouldn't benefit from. So those tend to be, in general, how we see counseling and education split out. Certainly, even within education and counseling within group and individual, there are different modes of delivery. So one-on-one in person is certainly probably the traditional and classic mode of delivery that we probably associate with this field the most. But in truth, most, particularly post-purchase counseling today, takes place over the phone. It's one-on-one, but it takes place on the telephone. Internet counseling is becoming more and more common, which takes place either by chat or by email or by some combination of filling out online forms and phone conversations with the counselor. So we have sort of a blending of the modes. In the education area, certainly internet is something that's talked about, and occasionally we see it. We do see some education that takes place online, much like this WIS line takes place here today, where people call in to a, you know, either a recording or a live seminar, sort of something like this, but on a home buyer topic. We also have the self-study or home study method, which we saw a lot of in the late 90s and early 2000s, where a lender or a mortgage insurer would send out a booklet and people had to work through the booklet and answer the questions and send back, you know, some proof that they worked through the booklet by answering the multiple choice test. And if they did that, then they would be qualified to proceed with a particular loan. So home study is another method. Home study is not widely used currently. You know, we've seen some proposals to do home study more on the internet or to use, you know, some combination of phone and home study, maybe DVDs that are sent home. But, you know, I'd say by and large, mostly what we see today are either phone and internet or, you know, facilitated in person or on the phone, as opposed to, you know, simply we send out a workbook and have you work through it. That has not been as frequently used as it maybe it was 10 years ago. So then as we start to think about the pre-purchase field specifically, there are a number of studies that we can look at that examine how pre-purchase counseling affects the thing that most lenders care the most about, which is, does the loan pay on time or not? That's kind of the $10,000 question, quite literally, for lenders. Do people, if they go through some kind of pre-purchase education or pre-purchase counseling, does that result in them being smarter about their mortgage, being more aware of the fact that due dates are important and that, you know, if they don't pay their loan, they could lose their house? And because of that knowledge, they're therefore more likely to pay on time. The industry would love to know the answer to this question, and if it were true, they'd probably be much more willing to invest in home buyer education and counseling than they currently are. There are, like I said, in general, in this field, not very many studies. The studies that we do have aren't necessarily conclusive, but the study that's most frequently cited among people in the home buyer education community and among policymakers is a paper by Harrod and Zorn. Peter Zorn is a long-standing housing economist who's done a lot of work in consumer education, worked at Freddie Mac. In fact, both the researchers worked at Freddie Mac. Using Freddie Mac data on a large number of loans, over 40,000 loans that Freddie Mac had made in the late 1990s and early 2000s. So these are loans that were made over 10 years ago now. And they tracked them for a couple of years, about 2 years after the loans were made. And they didn't really have a randomized study. So it wasn't as if certain buyers got home buyer education by some random assignment of a digit or something else. It was that certain buyers were required because they had a low down payment or certain other terms on the loan that required them to get education. And other buyers didn't have a low down payment or other terms that were less risky, and they weren't required to get the education. The problem you can probably foresee already is that the riskier people got the education, and the less risky people didn't get the education. So it wouldn't be surprising if you just looked at the data and said, gee, the people who got education were more likely to go to foreclosure because they were riskier to begin with. And so they came up with a pretty complicated way to try to tease out the differences between these two groups and then tease out the differences between how counseling was provided to each group. And they came away with the conclusion that there was very little effect of anything but face-to-face counseling. But they did find that face-to-face counseling resulted in about a 30% or a third reduction, 34% reduction in 90-day delinquency rates. So 90-day delinquency is a major number for the lending industry. 90 days delinquent means you've missed three payments. It's hard to get you back on track after that point in time. About half those loans will go to default, so there's a potential loss for the lender. You know, they found some effects, smaller effects of home study counseling or classroom counseling, but no effects of telephone counseling. Now, like I said, the problem was that the two groups of borrowers, those who got counseling and those who didn't, were really different. What they also found was that people who selected into face-to-face counseling were really different from people who selected into telephone counseling. So the most risky people who are most eager to get their loan where they're like most likely to use telephones, and the least risky, the people who are the most patient and the most, you know, the most willing to take their time and work through this process, willing to do face-to-face. So as you started to control for what kind of counseling they get, you find these really strong selection effects, such that the least risky people chose these more time-intensive ways, and the more risky people chose these less time-intensive ways. So it's completely unclear if the results of this study suggest that face-to-face counseling works and some doesn't. It is clear that people who select different kinds of counseling are different from each other, but it's not at all clear that somehow phone counseling is inferior to face-to-face counseling. So it's something the authors take great pains to make the case of. It's not that certain kinds of counseling don't work, more that in their data they aren't able to really tell if it's just the fact that people who select these two kinds of counseling are different, or if really counseling has differential effects. So they did more data analysis and raised more doubts about their results. So even though this study is widely cited in the industry, in the housing counseling industry, as being proof that homebuyer education works, this isn't a study that ever got published in any peer-reviewed journals, and the authors themselves don't go around promoting that this study proved that homebuyer education works. So it's an interesting study. It's one that proponents of homebuyer education and counseling will promote sort of in a self-serving way, but neglect the asterisk that has to be listed on this, which is it's never been peer-reviewed, and even the authors have backed away on on some of the results that take place here. So that's probably one, if you look much in this field, you'll see cited quite frequently. Next are a couple of studies that took place on a pool of loans in the Midwest, specifically in Ohio, by some researchers at Ohio State. And it actually did find some effects of counseling resulting in lower rates of default, at least initially. But they also found that people who got homebuyer education and counseling were more likely to pay off their loan early. And again, this wasn't randomized. So they're doing the same kinds of things that Herod and Zorn tried to do to try to model who chose each kind of group. But the results are pretty interesting because it raises the question for a lender. It's not just that if I make you smarter, you'll be more likely to pay me on time. If I make you smarter, you might be more likely to say, the rate on this loan isn't that great. I'm going to go get another loan. And so what happens is if I make you smarter, I might win as a lender because you don't have as many late payments, but I might lose because you end up refinancing my loan with a lower rate loan later. And so as a lender, based at least on this study, you're a bit of a quandary. Do I want to promote homebuyer education and counseling, which results in my borrowers not defaulting as much, but also may mean that I lose my best borrowers to another lender who offers them a lower rate? So it's an interesting finding. I think methodologically, that study is very strange in that it had a pretty small number of loans that were analyzed, and the loan product itself was very strange. The underwriting process involved a combination of counseling and actual financial support for people to get into these loans. So I think it's very hard to generalize because it's not a loan product that probably any of us see in any of our communities that where they actually work with people and change the terms based on what needs they might have. There's another paper that Roberto Garcia and John Spader did, John when he was at University of North Carolina and Roberto's still there. This is a peer-reviewed article, and they look at loans that have come through a special loan program in North Carolina called Self-Help Credit Union. Self-Help was very well known in the late 90s and 2000s. It got a big grant from the Ford Foundation to basically create a pool of money to secure large numbers of loans that self-help them went across the country to buy out of small banks. So they basically were trying to help small banks make more loans to low-income and minority borrowers by buying any loans that those banks had from low-income and minority borrowers. So it created a huge pool of loans for researchers to look at and to look at the performance of loans over time. And, this community advantage program, or what they call these loans, has been tracked continuously, and we still see studies coming out of this pool of loans. I think one thing we always have to be cautious about is that this was a very special program. It was a very unique credit union based in, community development credit union based in North Carolina, who got $50 million in money from Ford Foundation and support from Fannie Mae to go around the country, find good lenders to then buy loans out of. So it's a little different from a lender that's just making loans and seeing what happens. It's a different kind of process. Still, they had some evidence of people who received education and counseling, and the fact that they had loans from different states and different lenders is actually a big advantage in some ways, because we can generalize it a bit more. They weren't able to watch every borrower in the same way, so some borrowers they were able to track for a couple of years, some they were able to track for 5-6 years, so we had some differences in how many months we were able to track people. They were able to look at different kinds of counseling, so including telephone and other kinds of telephone, face-to-face, classroom, so all the different modes we talked about before. And by and large, they find, unlike the previous studies I talked about, no difference in method. So whether it was face-to-face or telephone, home study didn't matter. The effects that when they did happen were significant. So they did find that people who got the counseling were more likely to prepay their loans. So very similar to the last study I mentioned, where people learned a little bit and they're more likely to basically find an interest rate that was better and pay off the loan, or maybe they moved. That's another possibility, we don't know. What's difficult is that this particular study took place on loans in the early 2000s when interest rates were just going down every year. So it was a time when a lot of people were refinancing, and it's totally clear if that would continue to be the case. They found no effects on default. Again, if what we think is important is that people don't get in trouble as much, this actually doesn't find any evidence of that. It's found that they, more than anything else, prepay more often, which might be something that the lender sees as negative. Another study took place in Illinois because there was a perception, particularly in the city of Chicago, that there were borrowers who were being targeted by subprime lenders. So there were 10 zip codes where there was a lot of subprime lending going on. So there was actually a state law passed that said in these 10 zip codes, anybody who wants to get a loan has to go to counseling first. And it had a number of effects on the market. And there's some economists from the Fed who studied this in detail. And really, it's one of the best studies in the field. They find some effects, and they didn't have random assignment, but they were able to do very intensive statistical methods to try to show the effects. And they find that counseling is associated with about a 30% decrease in default. But what they don't find is that it's the counseling that has the effect. It's what they can't prove, at least, is that. What they suggest instead is that the way this program was designed, you had to go through a pretty rigorous process to be able to get a loan. And so the people who were the riskiest didn't want to go through that process, so they just sort of opted out of the market. Or more importantly, lenders who knew that this process was going to be so onerous in these 10 zip codes just stopped making loans in those 10 zip codes, with some of the worst lenders pulled out. So here's an interesting side effect of homebuyer education and counseling, is if you mandate it, particularly in certain areas, certain lenders will say, I don't want to deal with that process, and they'll pull out of the market. So in some ways, it was good if you got a loan, or good if you think about the effects for borrowers in these zip codes, and that fewer people went into default. But it's also less true that there were probably fewer loans offered in those zip codes, and the types of lenders in those zip codes were different than they're offered in other kinds of zip codes. So there was definitely a trade-off here, and that lenders responded to this counseling requirement and some pulled out, and maybe consumers had, fewer choices but better choices, but they certainly had fewer choices. It's also clear that some of the riskiest borrowers, the borrowers who maybe most needed credit, didn't stay in the market. So it's a very interesting study in that it suggests that we have to be careful what we wish for. If we wish that everybody had mandated financial education or mandated homebuyer education, it might change who's in the market, both on the the borrower side and the lender side. Can't say that this necessarily shows that pre-purchase counseling proves to have an effect on borrower behavior, but it certainly has some effect on the market overall and may reduce risk overall, although not necessarily because people are necessarily quote-unquote smarter. Another study I want to mention is important because it doesn't look at loan performance. And I think my personal opinion on much of this research is that we're so focused on what the lenders care about, which is people paying off their loan or people defaulting on their loan, that we forget that there might be other reasons to do financial education. Like, people aren't stressed, and, you know, people know what to do when trouble comes, and they're better neighbors and those kinds of things. So Andy Carswell, who's at the University of Georgia and does really nice work in housing economics, followed about 1,700 people in Philadelphia who went through a number of different financial counseling agencies. He followed them for 5 years, which is almost unheard of in research. You don't usually follow people that long. And got a pretty good response rate. About a quarter of them responded. And was able to look at how they did over time. Now, everybody in the sample got counseling, so we don't have anything close to a causal kind of study. But what's important about his study, I think, is that he looked at, some non-financial effects, including the fact that, you know, a lot of people said that they had to make sacrifices to be able to keep their home, that they had to make, you know, financial sacrifices. So it's, you know, it's also clear that people who got into trouble looked for help. But I think the real contribution of the study isn't so much what the results were, but that he was smart enough to track people for a long period of time and then to think about some outcomes that weren't just payment or non-payment. So I'm going to pause there. That sort of concludes the pre-purchase section. I'm going to then talk into post-purchase, which maybe people are more interested in anyway because that's sort of the hot topic of the day. But any questions on the pre-purchase side? All right, so let's talk about post-purchase. I would say, in terms of post-purchase, the study that I would like to see done is whether people who get some education before they get into trouble, but after they get into the home, behave differently. I think that oftentimes what happens pre-purchase is that we push people into getting the deal done, so they have to sort of jump through this hoop called home buyer education or home buyer counseling. And yet, once they get into the house, we sort of forget about them. And once they get into the house, there's lots of issues to come up with, like how do I budget to make monthly payments? How do I deal with repairs? How do I think about refinancing or not refinancing? How do I use my home equity? And how do I make my payments on time? But mostly what we see in terms of the literature are studies of people once they're already in trouble. And this is sort of the default counseling world. Default counseling is a broad set of issues. So default counseling might mean people who are delinquent on a tax payment, so they haven't paid their taxes since they get referred to counseling. It might mean people who are worried about not being able to make their payments, so they call a counseling hotline. Or it might mean people who are in default, meaning they've missed, you know, multiple payments. The lender is planning on filing a foreclosure case, which means they're going to start the process of repossessing the home. And all those are sort of encompassed within what's post-purchase counseling. Post-purchase counseling, as I mentioned earlier, those studies go back even to the 60s because FHA, which is the Federal Housing Administration of the U.S. federal government, had some issues with defaults, basically because there were some risky loans made at that point in time, and there was this idea that these nonprofit counseling agencies might make a difference. So there were some studies that took place back then, some of which attempted randomization, but most of which just didn't work because they weren't able to implement the study with fidelity, meaning that they didn't get enough people in each group to show any effect. We saw a resurgence of this research in the 2000s, particularly as the first wave of foreclosures started to come in the mid-90s, before the subprime bust and before the recession of 2008. We started to see some studies early on, though. One of them was one that I did in mid-2000s, where I had a sample of people who were in Chicago and got either face-to-face counseling or telephone-based counseling from Chicago NHS, what was unique about that study is I was able to figure out how many times each household was, basically how often they were mailed solicitations for counseling or for homebuyer seminars for people in trouble. So the city and the NHS collected data on who was in trouble in the neighborhood and how many loans were going bad in the neighborhood, and they focused their outreach particular areas. So I knew for each borrower how many times they were offered counseling. And the more they were offered counseling, the more likely they were to take up counseling. And so that proved to be a useful statistical instrument to look at not necessarily whether they took up counseling, but how often they were offered counseling and what the effect of the offer of counseling might be. So it got me over this problem of selection effects, that the riskiest people selected the counseling, which is extreme. In the default counseling side, people who come in for counseling tend to be the worst case scenarios. The people who are relatively well off will figure it out on their own. They don't come in at all. But anyway, what I was able to find from that study was, again, no control group, just relative to people who got less counseling predicted by this offer of counseling, is that each additional hour of counseling reduced people getting worse, meaning that they were more payments behind or went to foreclosure if they were not in foreclosure before, by about 3.5%. So pretty small. So if somebody got 4 hours of counseling, you know, it might be around, 14%. So it's not a huge reduction, but still a positive and significant effect, particularly for a relatively small group of people. Another paper, again by Roberto Garcia and his colleagues at the University of North Carolina, with that community advantage program set of borrowers, looked at a couple of different post-purchase counseling methods. One was a outbound call from the lender or from a counselor who the lender contracted with for people who were in default to try to get them to look at some budgeting and other activities. And another program was less proactive and more responsive to consumers who were in trouble. You know, generally they found some positive effects. Again, they didn't have a treatment and control group, so they're just trying to come up with a method of matching people who got counseling to other people who were in trouble who didn't get counseling. And they found that this post-purchase counseling reduced the rate at which people who were in trouble went on to lose their home. And they said about 50% higher, 50% more likely to stay in the home than to lose the home. It definitely is an unusual sample, as I described before, but it's suggestive that the counseling made some difference here. And again, we didn't have random assignment. Another study that Roberto Garcia did was in Minneapolis, looking at people who come through a major foreclosure prevention program that Minneapolis has really been a leader in homebuyer education and counseling for over a decade, and so they kept great data on their program. So Roberto and his colleague was able to look at each additional hour of foreclosure counseling, finding about a 10% decrease in people moving towards foreclosure. So, you know, again, this was not an experimental study, but, you know, the people who got the full complement of 8 hours of education had about a 50% reduction in going to foreclosure. So it was, again, suggestive that there is some positive effects, even though it wasn't randomized. The last couple of studies are very recent, neither of which are published yet. One is actually underwritten by NeighborWorks America, who funds the National Foreclosure Counseling Program, Foreclosure Mitigation Counseling Program. And they find that counseling has some positive effects on people looking for loan modifications, that they're more likely to get modifications and they get better loan modifications if they get counseling. And there's a study I have with the Max Meiser, who's now at the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C., where we look at people who called the HOPE hotline, the 888-995-HOPE hotline, and see how they performed on their loans after calling the hotline relative to people who didn't call. And you have to use some relatively complicated methods because the people who call obviously are in trouble, more in trouble than people who don't call. So what we end up doing is looking at a number of events that were sponsored in across the country. So each, almost every week, some city is the focus of a Hope Now event where they promote home buyer education and counseling for people in trouble. And what we find is that more people call the hotline around those events because it just heightens awareness. So if we use those events, as an instrument to look at the offer of counseling, we find some increase in loan modification and people who get slightly better modifications if they have that offer of counseling. So again, suggestive of positive effects, not randomized, but still we find at least some hope that the foreclosure counseling has some effects. Not huge effects, but definitely positive effects. So that's sort of the post-purchase side, and there are studies coming out all the time, particularly on the post-purchase side, because there's lots of data out there right now. Nobody still has randomized data, so we don't have any randomized studies going right now in terms of how home buyer education works or post-purchase counseling works, in part because, in general, people aren't willing to withhold counseling from people who are at risk of losing their home. And so that continues to be one of the reasons why we don't see a lot more studies that have more causal effects behind them. Before I open it up to questions, let me just offer some general conclusions. And these are listed in the brief as well as we think about home buyer education and counseling. And I think the first thing to remember is that this home buyer education and counseling field is very widespread and not at all standardized. We're talking about everything from, workbooks to online to phone, face-to-face of varying quality. So some programs are provided by HUD, Housing Counseling Certified Organization, and counselors who've gone through hours and hours of training with NeighborWorks or some other entity, and others who, just picked up a workbook and are working through it with, people in a church basement. So it's hard to generalize about this field. It's so different in terms of who's actually out there delivering programs. And programs have so many different forms. More than once, I've heard stories about a borrower sitting in the car with the realtor on the way to the closing, going through home buyer education on the phone. That's not what we mean by quality home buyer education, and it's hard to associate that with the kinds of programs that we think are important. The second thing that's crucial, and this is crucial for all financial education, not just home buyer, really, is that who decides to come in the door is the most important thing. Motivated borrowers on the pre-purchase side come in to get education. Distressed borrowers come in to get default counseling, post-purchase counseling. So it's very hard to tease out the selection effect versus the real effect of any particular program. Is it just that what we've created here is a giant screen so that, people who come in therefore are lower risk? And it doesn't matter what we say or do, because we know that they'll be better off just by virtue of the fact that they showed up. So selection is very important, and the biggest problem in the research is that we don't really have a good way to model the selection. The next thing is that when the service is delivered is really important. The study I mentioned that the Maximizer and I did of people in foreclosure counseling, if they came in when they were not yet behind or 30 days behind, one or two payments behind, they were much more likely to have positive effects of counseling than somebody who's, say, six payments behind. No amount of education can help you when you're six payments behind. So it's a very different kind of a model. Well, no amount will help you if your goal was to get people back in the house. At six payments behind, you may have to do education around how to get out of the house, and that may be very important. But clearly, when people come in is really important. If people come in after their purchase contract is signed on the house, on the pre-purchase side, it's going to be very hard to get them off of that train. They've got this vision of the house in their heads, and it's going to be hard to teach them anything. Certainly, I think it's going to make them think twice about their decision. The fourth thing I would suggest is that we focus too much on loan outcomes. I think the evidence is mixed on loan outcomes. Certainly, we see some positive evidence that people pay more. They're more likely to pay on time, but also that they're more likely to pay the loan off and refinance. And, those may cancel each other out. So for a lender, it's not all clear to me that home buyer education is a net benefit. Now, certainly, from a community banking perspective, I'd rather not see foreclosures, and I might be willing to accept the fact that I have to compete for a loan so I can deal with refinances. So there might be sort of community reasons to do it. But from a purely financial portfolio management side, it's not clear to me that home buyer education delivers the benefits that lenders might think. But maybe it's not just about those benefits. Maybe it's not just about homebuyer payment patterns, but about how stressed they are, about other sacrifices they're making, about their rest of their household budget, about their ability to be a good neighbor, to keep up their house, to do, to manage their home equity responsibly, to do repairs and maintenance responsibly, to be engaged in the community. Maybe that's the stuff that's more important. I think in some ways the lender agenda has driven the research so much that we've neglected maybe some of the outcomes that might be more important. And one thing I would say on the pre-purchase side is an outcome that might really matter is that people decide not to buy. They get the education before they sign the purchase contract, and they decide, you know what, I'm better off renting, or I'm better off renting for now, or I don't want to take this much risk or pay this much, or whatever the other issues are. So I think those are all outcomes that we generally don't think about as we get so caught up in loan outcomes. Overall, I think there are some modest effects. I mean, certainly having more information seems better than not having more information. And the effects are relatively modest. I don't think we're ever going to say that people who get education and counseling are, four times less likely to go to foreclosure or anything like that. The effects are going to be in the, single-digit percentages by and large. That said, homebuyer education and counseling are pretty cheap to offer. You're talking about a $100,000 loan where $5,000-$6,000 is going to a mortgage broker, and maybe more than that to a real estate agent and loan originator, appraiser, realtor, on and on. A relatively small amount of money. Most counseling sessions don't cost more than $100, $125, $150. That may really pay off. So maybe you only do get a 2% decrease in default, but it wouldn't take much for that 2% decrease in default to be justified for a $120 cost of homebuyer education. So it's a relatively cheap investment, and maybe it's a relatively small effect, but it doesn't take a huge, a huge effect to justify a relatively small cost in the overall scheme of things. So I think it's an important area to continue to focus on. I wish we could say we had more definitive evidence about what kinds of programs work. But like I say, this is sort of endemic in this field and not something that we should pick on the homebuyer counseling industry for specifically. So with that, I'll open it up and see if people have questions or comments or other issues they want to talk about.
This is Marian Kiwani. I'm curious about if there's any comparisons at all between people who are mandated to attend versus those who attend voluntarily. Obviously, people who are mandated sometimes, like here in Kiwani County, I see just a few number of people a year, so this is not certainly a big contribution on my part as far as time, but I do question my time on this. But anyway, they basically come in, and it's kind of a partnership with Lakeshore CAP that has the home buyer education program through a special grant. And so I offer the basically going through a teaching budgeting with them and, spend maybe 2 hours with them. And then that sort of meets a criteria for Lakeshore CAP. For either emergency housing or first-time homebuyers. So these people are motivated to come in voluntarily, which is not really voluntarily because of being able to get assistance with either a low-interest loan or temporary home mortgage assistance. So I'm just curious about, it's not really voluntary. You could say it's mandated because they're doing it to get something. And so I'm just kind of curious how this fits the definition of, those required folks that you were talking about.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think we see a mix of programs that are voluntary and that are required. In some cases, they're voluntary, but if you do it, you get some benefit, some reduction here or there.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess there's two ways to think about this. So the advantage of a mandated program is that you get over the selection effect. So what we worry about is if it's voluntary, only the best risks come in and the people who most needed it never came in. So
yeah.
To some extent, we like that everybody's coming in, regardless of whether you think you need it or not, and we're going to give you some baseline.
Mm-hmm.
The struggle with the mandated we've seen, because we've seen mandated programs in county programs and in state programs and even in some of the programs that national lenders like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have done. And what will happen is people, particularly the lenders and the mortgage brokers, will figure out the easiest way to get that mandate fulfilled. And that's when they come up with things like the telephone, you know, push 2 if you understand APR, those kinds of things, which, you know, I think we can all agree are kind of silly. So if the mandate has teeth and the mandate can be implemented so that people are really getting it in time to help them make better decisions and to really give them information that's pertinent, I think it can work. Now, people from an educator standpoint are probably not really highly motivated to be there. And so that makes it more challenging to teach those folks. But I think, you know, if we can sort of calibrate the level of the detail and try to make it as interesting as possible and make sure that it's not being gamed by the lenders, I think that mandate is probably the better strategy relative to just, you know, letting people come in. And, you know, generally we know who's going to come in are going to be the least risky people.
Well, that helps helps me understand a little better. I certainly see big difference in motivation. Just, I don't know, it just must be, you know, naturally occurring or not with people. And, you know, it's easy to see, you know, folks that, you know, it's like, oh, this is just a brand new idea. I just never realized this. It's kind of like, oh, this is, I think I can do this. Whereas somebody else is basically just not really interested in giving up kind of their spending lifestyle. And yet they can't make their home mortgage payment.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And we hear a lot of that. And I think at the state level, WEDA, the housing agency, has begun some conversations about how do we come up with a system so that more people want to get the education and they want to get it in time to try to make it work. And so they're really trying to work across the industry to get realtors and appraisers and everybody in the whole stream, lenders too, to agree that it would be good for people to know more earlier on and to create some incentives for that, including, you know, maybe there'll be some discount on your realtor fee or your appraisal fee or the other kinds of things if you can show that you've gone through a certificate of completion on some of these programs. So, you know, I think it's possible that there might be some new models coming forward that could be successful, but right now it's basically either you're mandated or it's volunteer, and in that world, the mandated might be the better bet.
And do you have any thoughts about, like, extension undertaking any study in this area, since there seems to be such an absence here of really reliable data?
I know
I'm asking a question that's, you know, kind of a big question.
Yeah, I mean, I'd always like to see better study in this area. I think that the challenge is that, you know, a good study in this area almost has to come from a lender, you know, like a WEDA or, you know, one of the larger lenders to say, okay, these people, they're going to get it, they're going to be mandated to get it, and these people, we're not going to mandate to get it. So that, for two reasons. One, because they have the power to sort of select, and rather than the people selecting. Now, the education can be provided by Extension or by people who Extension trains or curriculum that Extension creates, and I think that could be a great role for us. But then the loan performance and the longer-term follow-up, the lenders are really ideally suited to do. So it would take a really good lender partner to pull off. And like I said, most lenders aren't highly motivated on this, so it's hard to find a good lender partner to make it work. But I'd love to do it if somebody has a way to make it happen.
Okay, thanks.
So, Michael, what are you feeling our role should be? I heard Mary say that she does the budgeting portion of it. But as I strike up new relationships with WEDA and rural housing, is this an area I should be spending my time in doing home buyer education?
So I don't know the answer to that question. Here's what I could tell you. I know that WEDA and rural development are very interested in trying to have a high-quality home buyer education and counseling system across the state. And I know that they would really like Extension to play a key role in that because they see Extension as being high-quality. The challenge, I think, with the home buyer education area is that it is a lot more than just budgeting. And, you know, by and large, there are already these existing entities that do certification and training in these areas. You know, so if you're in a neighborhood, if you're in a community that has like the NeighborWorks groups or the neighborhood housing services groups, you know, they take part in multiple training. I think they do 6 trainings a year on topics in these areas. So they have this infrastructure already built up that we don't currently have. I think the other thing is that we're beginning to see more use of, you know, mixed technology, so online and phone, and you know, where that dividing line between face-to-face and these other methods are, I think is sort of being, is evolving. I know some of you were involved with the WIDA method of, they did the tele, I forget what you call it now, but teleconference, you know, whatever, the TV screen method of homebuyer education. And then, they, you know, they'd break out and you could step in and do pieces of it. I think that's a technology that's still evolving as well. I've heard mixed reviews of that. So I guess my sense is that this is a good thing to sort of be in the midst of, but we sort of have to figure out what our key role is and what we do well and what others might do well and where we might fit in. You know, it's very possible that the more technical aspects of this are delivered by a different entity, and then the model we just talked about where, you know, maybe the more family financial aspects are done by folks from Extension, like budgeting. Maybe that's the ideal model. Maybe that's where things evolve. I think the next couple of years we're going to see some movement in this area. The big issue is going to be how it's all paid for. And I think that's what WIDA is really trying to crack now, is can we figure out a way to build in discounts or something else so that people have some incentive to do this work and there's money available so that we can really build up a robust system in this area. Does that help? Kind of a non-answer.
No. you did clear up the picture for me.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that I think the post-purchase stuff is, it will exhaust you. It is very technical work. And, you know, if you can find some other way to have post-purchase default counseling services delivered in your community, that would be ideal. On the post-purchase side, we do have the WIP, the Wisconsin Homeownership Preservation Education Curriculum, which is on the fyi.ux/.edu/WHPE website. That does include a lot of the topics I talked about before, like how to refinance and how to maintain your home, you know, before people get into trouble. I think that might be a really nice niche for Extension, sort of pre-crisis. You know, basic household management, basic housing management, that might make a lot of sense. It's not the technical stuff. It's not the crisis management stuff, which will really eat you up. It's more the prevention type work, and that's probably a better niche.
Well, this has helped me sort of understand this whole bigger picture about an activity that I have been participating in actually for quite a number of years, although to a very limited extent, and I've done it more as a partner with our Lakeshore CAP agency. So it helps step back and sort of look at that whole big picture of what's really known, because I actually, you know, I've been doing it somewhat as a, you know, as a partner contribution, really. And I certainly understand what you're saying about motivation playing such an important role in what people take away. But I guess that's true for all of our programs, really. You know, it's so easy to see when you have, you know, someone come in who's highly motivated, and if they do come in that way, I have offered for them to come back again to, you know, sort of follow it along, and they really get it. But then, you know, with others, it doesn't seem like it really, you know, they're just basically there to get the temporary money. And so I totally see what you're talking about with the motivational aspect of where people are coming from when they come in. But it is highly gratifying. I worked with a young couple with a small baby who it was shocking to me that they had, you know, were new homeowners and just really seemed to be quite naive about just some of the most basic budgeting. And so it seemed like it was just much more beneficial to them, because it was like, you know, just this big eye opener. We went through some of these different things, and they were able to implement quite a few things in relatively short time. So, I mean, right there, that motivational difference can make a very big difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I would just, this is a topic that I, like I said, I appreciate not only the research, but as a practitioner too. And so if anybody's dealing with issues in these areas and wants to, you know, talk to me one-on-one, I'm always happy to do that because, you know, I can give some sense of what I've seen before and where it might be make more sense to focus time and energy. So I'm always happy to do that. Okay, with that, we're coming up to our closing time, but I just want to thank you all for being on the kickoff call of this year. I want to remind you that we will do Building Bucks this month. It's a little strange because of both the holiday and because of some other WISP lines that have been scheduled. The Building Bucks call is going to be at noon instead of 1, and it's going to be on the 24th, which is technically the fourth Monday. So we're slightly off on the Building Bucks schedule, but that should be clear on the Building Bucks website. In terms of lunchtime learning, our next call will be on February 14th, Valentine's Day. We're talking about legal issues like garnishment. So I guess, you know, we're looking at the other side of Valentine's Day when things don't go well. So we're going to look at some legal issues of collections and garnishment. So we'll send out those materials in advance. Again, it'll all be posted on the FYI site. So I thank you all for your time today and look forward to hearing from you later this month and next month.